person that you're married to, the relationship is so dysfunctional that you have disengaged from one another, and you really don't have a lot to do with each other's lives. You share a postal code, but not a lot of life. And that can be painful as well. And then part of the problem as well is that we may have a lopsided view of marriage. If the only text on marriage that we know is the one that we looked at last week in Genesis chapter 2, you remember the one that began, "It is not good for the man to be alone. I will make him a helper suitable for him." And it ends with, "For this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother." Well, if that's the only passage that you know about marriage, and if you haven't thought sufficiently about it, you might conclude that singleness is second class. On the other hand, if the only passage about marriage that you know is the one that we're going to look at today, 1 Corinthians 7, you might conclude that marriage is second class. And you'll find out what I mean, I think, as we begin reading that. So I want to read a couple of verses from 1 Corinthians 7. There's way more there than we have time to touch on today, but we'll look at the passages that deal with singleness, and I want to read to you today, not from the NIV, which is what I usually use, but I want to go to Eugene Peterson's The Message, because I think he really, you know, at a street level, hits the nail on the head. So let's begin in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, and I'm going to start with verse 7. Paul writes, "Sometimes I wish everyone were single like me." Can you believe that? That's what he said. Let me read it again. "Sometimes I wish everyone were single like me, a simpler life in many ways. But celibacy is not for everyone any more than marriage is. God gives the gift of the single life to some and the gift of the married life to others." Verse 25, "The master did not give explicit directions regarding virgins," or that is the unmarried, "but as one much experienced in the mercy of the master and loyal to him all the way, you can trust my counsel. Because of the current pressures on us from all sides, I think it would probably be best to stay just as you are. Are you married? Stay married. Are you unmarried? Don't get married. But there's certainly no sin in getting married, whether you're a virgin or not. All I'm saying is that when you marry, you take on additional stress in an already stressful time. And I want to spare you if possible." And then finally, verse 32, "I want you to live as free of complications as possible. When you're unmarried, you're free to concentrate on simply pleasing the master. Marriage involves you in all the nuts and bolts of domestic life and in wanting to please your spouse, leading to many more demands on your attention. The time and energy that married people spend on caring for and nurturing each other, the unmarried can spend in becoming whole and holy instruments of God." What an interesting way of comparing marriage and non-marriage. "I'm trying to be helpful and make it as easy as possible for you, not make things harder. All I want is for you to be able to develop a way of life in which you can spend plenty of time together with the master without a lot of distractions." Our passage today is about the advantages of singleness. I remember once asking a seminary professor what he found most challenging about raising a family. He didn't bat an eyelash. He said, "Oh, that's simple. It's just keeping everybody happy." Well, if he was single, of course, he wouldn't have to worry about that. Here's a question for you. What do Jesus, John the Baptist, Paul, Anna, Simeon, these are, you know, part of God's all-star team in the New Testament, right? And coming into the present, John Stott. Anybody here ever heard of John Stott, the famous Anglican clergyman? I was reading him for years. I didn't even know he was Anglican. I actually didn't know what an Anglican was at the time. So what do all of these people have in common? And of course, they're single. These are people who, by all accounts, have accomplished much for the kingdom of God, and they did it as singles. So those of us who are married and think, you know, marriage is the be-all, end-all, And a lot of people who are married act that way and think that way. Maybe we have another thought coming. And Paul will have some things to say about that. Paul in 1 Corinthians has a lot to say about singleness, a lot of positive and supportive things. In fact, as you ponder his endorsements of the single life, you may leave feeling a little bit guilty about the fact that you married. Seriously. So let me summarize for you some of the high points of 1 Corinthians 7. There's really just three. So we'll summarize the high points, and then I want to talk to you about some of the myths of singleness, and then I want to give you some what you might call myth busters, things that will help us, particularly those who are married, to better engage with and relate to those who are single. There's something about singleness, point one in verse 7. There's something about singleness that was so sweet, so right, and so good that it made Paul wish that every Christian was single. Isn't that something? Of course, it's only a wish. And at the end of the day, the gift of celibacy, like the gift of marriage, is something that only God can give. There are some people who seem quite unable to function well as adults outside of marriage. And conversely, there are those who seem to function best in a single context. Celibacy and the gift of marriage are God-given capacities, sovereignly distributed, but still, Paul said it was his wish. Secondly, in verses 25 to 31, as providence would have it, Paul says, these days it's especially desirable for Christians who are single to stay single. Well, what did he mean by that? He doesn't say. He assumes that his readers know what he's talking about, what he has in mind. Scholars and historians tell us that, and it's referred to in verse 26, the present crisis. There's something going on in their part of the world. And there are many who would suggest that there was a famine and serious food shortages, and life was just really hard. We think of the Great Depression. Have you ever done any reading about the Great Depression? Have you ever met anybody who lived through the Great Depression here in North America? Come with me next time I go and visit Edgar Martin's in one of our senior lodges. This guy, he lived the Depression. He rode the rails. You know, there are people who rode the rails? Edgar rode the rails from Saskatchewan all the way to Toronto in search of work. I mean, these were desperate times. Desperate times called for desperate measures. And so Paul says, right now, we're going through desperate times. Is this the time for marriage? Is the question that he would have raised with the young couples in their church. A more modern example would be wartime. Can you imagine during the days leading up to World War II, if an engaged couple was weighing, you know, should we get married before the war, before you go to war, or should I wait until you come back from the war, and then we'll get married? I'm sure there are many. I'm sure there were many conversations just like that in World War II. Is this a time to be getting married? Is this a time to be taking on a wife and children? Many would have said probably not. But then more broadly and more generally, thirdly, in verses 32 to 35, Paul says, overall, singleness offers a believer extraordinary opportunity for service. And those of us who are married need to listen to what Paul has to say here. As my colleague at Unity Baptist, Ben Toms, is fond of saying, Paul really, really values singleness. And he never says it just once. He follows it up with a, Paul really, really values singleness. Not only does he value singleness, he recommends it. Not only for men, but also for women. Why? Why was Paul so big on singleness? Two reasons. 32 to 34, he says a single person has a freedom in serving Jesus Christ that a married person does not. Now, you don't really have to think about that a whole lot to figure it out, but I have to confess, it's not something I have thought about a lot. Being married with children can complicate your availability and your mobility. A single person is free to take risks and move. Now, let me read a quote to you from Irina Taylor, who used to serve in Kenya. She writes, being single has meant that I am free to take risks that I might not take were I a mother of a family dependent on me. Being single has given me freedom to move around the world without having to pack up a household first. And this freedom has brought to me moments that I would not trade for anything this side of eternity. Wow. Kind of makes a lot of sense, doesn't it? Secondly, not only does a single person have freedom to move, a single person has fewer distractions in their life and so can focus single-mindedly on serving the Lord. Free to focus on the majors, not as concerned about braces and glasses, sleepovers and security. You don't have to worry about whether your spouse is going to have another gallstone attack, and you don't have to try to remember wedding anniversaries. And just think, if you had a grocery list of all the things that are in your life because you are a married person, it's a long list, and they translate often into distractions. So those are three reasons, Paul says, why he prefers singleness over the married life. Some myths about singleness. Myth number one, married people understand singleness. That's a myth. We think we understand singleness, but we don't. Margaret Clarkson was a Canadian, has written hymns, and she makes this point in her book on singleness. Because married people were all single once, they tend to think that they know all there is to know about singleness. I suggest that this is not so, that there is a vast difference between being single at 25 or 30, with marriage still a viable possibility, and being single at 45 or 50 or 60 with little or no prospect of ever being anything else. Singleness has a cumulative effect on the human spirit, which is entirely different at 50 than it is at 30. So maybe I don't know that much about singleness. Maybe I should get to know a single person and find out from them what it's like. Myth number two. To be single is to be lonely. How many of us have ever thought that? Boy, I'm glad I'm not single, because if I was, I would be lonely. While it is true that marriage is one of God's great gifts to address our need for companionship and community, duh, it's not his only gift. He has many other gifts that he has given us. Family and friendships and ministry partnerships and the Christian church are all ways God addresses our need for community. My wife reminded me the other day, yes, it's true, you can be single and lonely, but you can also be married and lonely. I have met some very lonely people, and they have wedding bands on their hands. So apparently, marriage does not guarantee rich, satisfying partnership. It could, but it doesn't necessarily. Before Diane met me, she had learned to be content as a single woman. She led a full, satisfying life. She was professionally competent. She was successful. In fact, she didn't think she would get married. She was active in her church and in serving. There was a time when she had thought she would marry, that she hoped that she would marry, but the Lord, as only the Lord can do, brought her to a place of contentment. And it was only then that she and I met. That's kind of funny how that works sometimes. Another myth. So myth number one, married people understand singles. Myth number two, to be single is to be lonely. Myth number three, singles need to be fixed. And you know who's going to fix them? The marrieds, right? Singles need to be fixed. They don't need to be fixed. They're not weird. They're not incomplete. Give your head a shake. Jesus Christ was single, and he was the most fully human and complete person who ever lived. He didn't need marriage to complete him, but he and we all need community to function well. We may not all need marriage, but we all need community and friendships, and that God offers us all. Singles need to be fixed. That's a myth. And then similar to that, singles need to be paired off. People would say, or Paul would say, I hope not. If you can manage staying single, I'm quoting again from my friend Ben Toms, the Baptist minister. If you can manage staying single, you will accomplish more as a Christian than a married one. You'll be able to take advantage of more opportunities to make the world a better place than a married Christian whose effectiveness is often limited by their domestic responsibilities. Those of us who are married, we have so many things to do other than ministry if we're going to be faithful husbands and wives and responsible parents. We invest so much time and so much money in the domestic sphere of our life. And we should if we're married. Then the last section, I just call this miscellanea. Miscellanea is when you don't know where else to put it. So you put it all under that heading. Here, maybe these are myth-busters. I was trying to think of some things that you and I can be doing to better engage within a local church, singles and married. And I've missed some, and I hope you will tell me later on which ones I need to put into the list. The first one is that those of us who are married need to include singles in our circle of friendship and home hospitality. When you're thinking of who to have over on Friday night or Sunday after church, invite a single person and invite someone who's married as well and bring them together. And then those of you who are married, don't just talk about your kids. Because as fascinating as your children are, after about 10 minutes, we're ready to move on to the next subject. So there's more to our lives than our children, and we can build relationships with each other. Another myth buster, tell singles the truth about marriage. Not all of it. There are some things about your marriage you should not be telling anybody else. But tell singles the truth about marriage. Marriage is hard. Marriage is disappointing. I got married thinking that my spouse would do X, Y, and Z for me, and you know what? They don't, or they can't, or they won't. We marrieds, we struggle a lot. We complain. Some of us might even curse under our breaths. I have a friend who's really smart. He's married. He's well-educated. He has served in some pretty impressive leadership roles. He has a wonderful wife. I knew her because I grew up with her. And he said to me one day, if my wife passed away, I think I asked him, I said, if your wife ever passed away, would you get remarried again? Not on your life, he said. No way. He said, marriage has been so hard. There have been health issues. There have been other issues. And he said, once is enough for me. I'm not getting remarried. We ought to tell singles the truth about marriage. It's not all a Garden of Eden. Thirdly, I wonder if we sufficiently respect the courage of those who dare to be single. I have a lot of respect for singles who are wise enough not to get entangled with the wrong sort of person. Somebody wrote a book about that. And there was a chapter in it called The Courage to Stay Single. And one paragraph said, Mara had the courage. She was already wearing a diamond ring when she began to realize that Larry's moods were so unpredictable that in spite of all the qualities for which she adored him, he was not good husband material. Nor was he ready to be a father. She thought of his moods, those black moods, and she shuddered and stood by her courage and called it off. I would help any of you break off an engagement if it needed to be done. I wouldn't be nearly so enthusiastic about helping you break off a marriage, but I would help you break off an engagement. Far better to do that. Fourthly, we should applaud the faithfulness of the single person who wishes they were married but isn't. They really wanted to be married. They were waiting. They were looking. They were praying for Mr. or Ms. Wright, but they never came along. And they don't know why. And whenever they've tried to get information out of their maker, he's been strangely silent. It just never happened. At the end of the day, there are features in all of our lives that we don't wish for ourselves, but nevertheless are our lot in life. This may be one of those situations where a Christian who wants to marry but isn't, needs to bow before the sovereignty and the goodness of God. Again, Margaret Clarkson. She writes, through no fault, she's in her 60s now and she's still single, through no fault or choice of my own, I am unable to express my sexuality and the beauty and intimacy of Christian marriage, as God intended when he created me, a sexual being in his own image. To seek to do this outside of marriage is, by the clear teaching of Scripture, to sin against God and against my own nature. As a committed Christian, then, I have no alternative but to live a life of voluntary celibacy. I must be chaste, not only in body, but in mind and spirit as well. Since I am now in my 60s, I think that my experience of what this means is valid. I want to go on record as having proved that for those who are committed to doing God's will, his commands really are our enabler. Could I trust and follow a God who withheld from me some of the desires of my heart, things that are good and right and holy? And if for whatever reason God said, no, no marriage for you, could I love and obey a God like that? She goes on, Margaret Clarkson, to say, when referring now to A Pilgrim's Progress. Anybody ever read Pilgrim's Progress anymore? It used to be sort of essential reading. When Christian was crossing the river at the close of Pilgrim's Progress, his heart failed him for fear. He began to sink in the cold, dark waters. But Hopeful, his companion, helped him to stand, calling out loudly, "Be of good cheer, my brother. I feel the bottom, and it is good." Then Christian recovered his faith and passed safely through the waters to the celestial city. If there are singles who find the waters of singleness dark and deep, who feel, "I sink in deep waters, the billows go over my head, all his waves go over me," this is my message to you concerning singleness. Be of good cheer, my brother, my sister. I feel the bottom, and it is good. And last, what if we repented of our tired stereotypes of singles? Well, for example, we all know what a single woman looks like, don't we? Oh, she's frumpy, lonely, withdrawn, bitter, and she has lots of cats. One writer that I read this week said, "I used to think that. And then I met Flo, her new friend. Flo was beautiful, likable, smart, funny, fashionable, interesting, and of course she was single. And her stereotype just went up in smoke." Have you met some Flos in your life? When I was growing up at Grant Memorial Baptist Church in Winnipeg, there was a fella that led our CSB program, Christian Service Brigade, kind of like Boy Scouts, a Christian version of Boy Scouts. Ed. Ed was the guy. He was our leader. Ed was handsome. Always had a tan. He must have gone on holidays during the winter, because you don't get tans like that in Winnipeg in the winter. He was stylish. He was educated. He was professionally successful. He was a principal. He drove a sporty car. I thought that was pretty cool. He was winsome. He was one of the first adults that I could ever remember asking me for my opinion about an important issue. He wanted to know what I thought. What I thought, he thought, mattered. This guy gave his life away to boys at Grant Memorial Baptist Church. He discipled us without calling it discipleship. He discipled us without telling us that he was discipling us. Oh, and did I mention he was single? Never married. This guy flourished. I feel like my life, what would you say it? You underperform. Sometimes you get beside certain people and you feel like, oh, I'm an underperformer. This guy, he really got the job done. That's pretty much all that I have to say today about singleness. I've sort of exhausted myself at this point. But let's go to the last side. Where do you fit in the equation? Single, married? If you're single, have you considered your advantages lately as opposed to the disadvantages? Have you appreciated them? Have you thanked God for them? And Are you putting them to good use? You've got some, you can do some things that I can't do. You can do some things way better than I will ever be able to do them because of the advantages of your station in life. And then on the other side of the coin, of, are you married? And I want to ask myself and my married brethren here whether or not they are seeking to be a blessing to the singles around them. Do our singles feel valued and cherished? Do we elevate them as we should? Historically, singles have been and continue to be a very important part of God's plan. I thank God for the singles at Balmoral. We need them. They make us better. They make us look better than we really are. May God bless. Father, we thank you for Jesus, and he was single. It's really something when we consider that the Son of Man lived in this world and found full satisfaction in his relationships with his disciples and his family of origin and his friends and neighbors, and then also in this new community, the church, that he instituted. And we would all take our lead from him. You have designed us not simply for marriage, but you have designed us for community. Forgive us for the ways in which we pretend or we imagine that we can really go it alone when we can't. I thank you for all the brothers and sisters, the family and the friends that I have here at Balmoral. Help us to love each other, to respect each other, to lean upon one another when we need to. And we thank you for the Christ who stands behind all of this. We pray in his name.